Yes, it is. Yes, how are you?
Good. How are you doing?
Well, we're just about ready to start. That's all I can tell you as far as taping. Well, he's setting it up now as we talk. She wants to know if she should call back.
No, we're ready.
Well, he claims we're ready.
Okay, that sounds great. You know, it's terrible here in New York.
It is?
There's ice storms, explosions, one of the worst days.
I used to live through all of that.
I know you did. You used to work through all of it too, right?
All the time. Between Boston and New York and Philadelphia and New York, I was always going back and forth.
To the triads, right?
Yes, these are triads prior to coming to New York.
Right. So you would go and shoot pictures of the triads?
That's right. Usually they start after the the curtain goes down. And They give you 1 hour for food and stay in your finale costumes. Because I used to do it differently than most photographers. I used to shoot the show while it was in action. And then when the show ended, they would be in their finale costumes. So it saves us time. Because we would never have enough time. When they give you 3 hours for a straight play and 4 hours for a musical. And sometimes the musicals run so long, you just can't get anything out of it.
Right, and also, I guess, when you were shooting the tryouts, you didn't know how the thing was going to be received.
Exactly right.
To get the most attention, what was that like?
That was okay, but I got along with the stars of the show very well. I had no problems with them, just one. That's about it, I can tell you. And I have her name if you need it, so she didn't get along with me, and I don't know why. It was the first Tony Awards, and what happened was she came down the aisle, and I didn't even see I was talking to somebody, and she walked right over and into my conversation with the gentleman I was talking to, and she says, "No pictures, please." And I didn't answer her because I didn't even know who she was. She was Marlene Dietrich. So this is what happened. But this happened, went through for a couple of years. No matter where I was, she seems to find me. And I don't know why she didn't like me, but she didn't. And the feeling was mutual.
Do you think it was you particularly she didn't like, or just anybody with the camera?
You just hit it on the nose. Anybody with a camera, I think she would love. But not me. And if I can repeat something, I was doing a story on Marie Chevalier, and he said to me, "I have two bottles of champagne, one for Denise Arcel and one for Marlene Dietrich." He says, I said, "Well, she doesn't like me." He says, "She doesn't." He says, "How can anybody not like you?" I said, "You got me. I have no idea. I never saw her before in my life." But that was it. So he said, "Well, I'll give them to the doorman and let them bring it upstairs, and we'll go on to Miss Dietrich's daughter's apartment up on Fifth Avenue," which is what we did. And he got out of the car, and I said, "I think I better stay here, because if she sees me, she runs down the street and runs away." And that's how bad it was. But I had no problem with anybody else. And he said, "You stay in the cab and I'll talk to the driver." And he got out and talked with her. You can hear him talking in French and English and whatever language he knows. But he said, "I would like to have, would you mind if I tell you, I would like to have a photograph of the baby in the carriage with all of us?" She says, "Oh, I would love that." And so he turns around and he calls me to come out of the cab. I step out of the cab, maybe I take two steps. She runs to the carriage, runs down the street, runs around the corner and up the service elevator. And it's the last I ever saw her for what we were doing. But Tell me. I know. But this, I got along with most anybody. The one that everyone thought I would have trouble with was Katharine Hepburn. And I knew nothing about Katharine Hepburn except she didn't want me to photograph the show. And so I didn't understand why. She never saw me before, but she wanted her Hollywood boys to do the work. And the management said, no, he's got to do it for you. And she relented and said, okay. And I didn't say anything to her. The only one that spoke to her during that was the first day of rehearsal. And Alfred Drake walked in and walked up to her and said, hiya, Kate, how are you? And she looked at her watch and she said, you have 32 seconds. You're late. I don't ever want to see this again. And everybody in the show was flabbergasted that she would talk that way. She didn't never talk very much. So we continued on from there, and so I shot the show. And what I did was, in those days, we used to use 4x5 speed graphic cameras, and I broke it down to a 35 millimeter without telling anybody anything. And we just did it that way. And when that weekend, I sent the proofs to the press agent who took it to her. He called me back screaming, why did you make them small? She won't be able to see it. I said, I sent along with that package a flashlight it had a magnifier. I X'd out the proofs, and I X'd them out with a red grease pencil, or I left it alone. And that meant I thought they were all right. And that was the end of that session. And so what happened was Monday, it was on a weekend, and on Monday, the phone rang, and someone said to me, Katharine Hepburn wants to speak to you. So I said, well, I guess it's my turn. And I didn't say anything. I said, good morning, Miss Hepburn. How are you? And her first words to me were, you're damn good, fella. I said, would you please repeat that? So she just broke up completely when I said that. And she repeated it again. And I said, I liked it very much the first time, but the second time I liked it even better. And she couldn't talk to me anymore. She was so hysterical. But I thought that was the highlight of the whole thing that we talked about. But I became extremely friendly with her. And she was always calling me to do this, do that, and do various other things. She never called me Leo. It was always Mr. Friedman. I always called her Miss Hepburn. We never had anything other than our names. But she seemed very comfortable that way, and as long as she was comfortable, it was okay with me. And then we got to the rehearsals, where she sat in the theater across the aisle from me, and she was with another lady. And what happened with that was that she was very self-conscious. She didn't want to be bothered with anybody. I can understand her in that position. But she winked and waved to me across the aisle, and that was it. But in walked a couple of kids who had just gotten married, and she saw Miss Hepburn sitting in her seat, and she says, "I'm going to ask her for an autograph for my kid sister." I said, "Oh boy, it's going to come now. I'm sure of that." And she walked over and said, "Miss Hepburn, may I have your autograph for my kid sister?" And she was leaning down into her handbag on the floor, where her seat was, and she looked up at this child, and actually like a child. She looked up at her and said, "Not even for your dear, sweet mother." And I was floored. I couldn't believe that you would say that. But she did. And there were many instances that she was involved in. One was she was rehearsing in her last show for Stratford, Connecticut, where we were doing this. And we walked in for rehearsal. I did, anyway, and she walked in later. There were two old fellas sitting on the edge of the seat just talking to themselves, and he saw her. He says, hello, are you the cleaning lady around here? To Miss Hepburn. And she, Hepburn looked at me and just couldn't talk again. She was laughing so hard. And she said, yeah, I'm the cleaning lady around here. He said, well, you better get this place cleaned up because Katharine Hepburn's coming, and she'll just sock you with other things that you won't, might not like too much. And she said, well, where are the brooms? And this old guy got her a broom, and she swept out the rehearsal hall and just laughing through it. And the third one that I'm trying to think of, another one that she told me, oh, it just slipped my mind, but anyhow, she was very fantastic as far as I was concerned. I had a lot of big names. What's that?
And which show was this? Was this
Coco
that you were shooting?
No, this was a summer spec. No, Coco was the last show I photographed. And so then she told me, I told her I was going on holiday and I won't be around to do the last show, but it'll be taken care of by my men. She says, oh, I want you. I don't want anybody else. I just want you. I said, I can't cancel my reservations. She says, I'll pay for them. She would do it. She says, I just want you. I said, well, you'll have confidence in the man that I'm going to send. He happens to be my partner, Joe Abels. And so I went, and when I came back, I walked into a dark theater, and she was on stage rehearsing her part. And she looks into this dark theater. I was here, and John Houseman was about 10 feet away from me. He was the director, who never smiles. And when she walked in and looked in the theater, and she said, saying, is that John? You, John? She said, well, what is it that you want? Can you come back? Can they come back later and finish shooting? She says, I want to speak to Mr. Friedman. Isn't that him back there in the dark? So he said, I don't know Mr. Friedman, but there is a man sitting there in the dark. And I waved to him with my arms, and I said, yes, you know, as best I could do that. And so I said, I walked down, and I was sitting with her at the edge of the stage, and I said, boy, you know, you don't realize it, but I'm in a lot of trouble right now. She says, what kind of trouble? I said, well, when you go away, Mr. Houseman will raise holy heck with me. Who knows if I'll still be around? And I walked away, and she said to me as I was walking, if John Houseman says anything that bothers you in any way at all, you let me know, and I'll straighten him out. And that was the end of that. And that's why I always wanted to do her first. She was a fantastic lady. She really was. But this is how it goes. Some are good and some are bad. And she turned out to be my buddy. We go bike riding and, how are we doing, Mr. Friedman, you know? And she was always, Spencer's coming this weekend. He never showed up all summer. So I felt sorry for her when she told me that. But that was about it with Hepburn. There was a lot of little things. Coco was a different story. That was the last show I shot as a professional photographer in the theater. But she knew how to handle herself, that lady did. The reason I think that she wanted everything in Stratford, Connecticut is that her father lives in Connecticut, and she also used to, before she was very big in Hollywood, also lived there. So she's sort of a little more useful doing some place that she had been to before. And that's the only thing I could figure out. And then we switched to something else and on to whatever we had to do.
Can you tell me about how you got started with Mike Todd?
Well, as a child, I was 16 years old, and I was at a dance class in Carnegie Hall. And a woman came over to my mother and said to my mother, they're having auditions for a Broadway show called White Horse Inn, which has been running for years in Europe. And she said to my mother, I think your son would be good for one of the parts in that musical. And my mother said, but they want 12-year-olds, and he's 16. She says, tell them you're 12. So my mother and I walked over. It was one block from Radio City Music Hall, and the stage door was there, and we went in. And Sammy Lambert was the stage manager, who I became friendly with later on. It's the first time I've ever seen him. Grabbed my hand and walked me down to the headlights. And what happened there was Sammy didn't say a word. He just stood there with me, and this was supposed to be an audition as far as I was concerned. So I told him I was 12 years old, and he never made any remark about it. I must have looked very young, believe me. And Sammy was standing there waiting for whoever was supposed to talk to me to come up on stage, and all of a sudden there were two men down in the orchestra talking to each other and staring up at the stage, and this one man said, "Wait there, don't let him get away." So up he comes, and he walks on stage, and he walks up to me, and he says to me, "You cut your hair, I cut your pay." And I said, again, I didn't know how to answer him. So he said, that was the end of the conversation, because I was now in a Broadway show. That was the audition. The show opened with Billy Gaxon and Kitty Carlisle as the stars, and I became extremely friendly with Mr. Gaxon, more or less through my wife, who said, it was Mrs. Gaxon who was a big customer in Milgram's, the couture house in those days. And she told my father that I was in her husband's show. And my father didn't even know what she was talking about, because he never followed this stuff very much anyway. And next thing I know, I'm called into Billy Gaxton's dressing room. And we got talking, and he says, you're a nice young man, and so forth. And he said, I have a project. And he says, and I'd like to take you into it with me. And so he took me, he had a fantastic overcoat. It was wintertime. And he takes me over to the Alvin Theater, and he hands me these flowers. They look like weeds. And he says, I want you to take them down the aisle here at Cecil Merman's dressing room. If she's there, don't do anything. Come back out. If she isn't, put them down on the table and run out. And Bob Hope was in that show. And as I'm running out the door, he says, hey, you, what are you doing here? And I didn't say anything. I just went and got out, and Gaxon took me away. And he left her a bunch of what they call snake weeds. They had a thing going between them, you know, just for laughs. In fact, I never saw a Broadway show start and stop the way Billy Gaxon did it on stage. He walked over and he says, ladies and gentlemen, I have a surprise for all of you. And sitting here in the audience is Ethel Merman. And Ethel, would you please get up and let the photographer see who you are, and then help Miss Merman get up, which he did, and everybody was applauding and screaming. She was very popular, but so was he, because this man had a show that won the Pulitzer Prize, Out of the Eyes Sing, but he was in so many hits on Broadway, you just can't imagine. I wrote a book, and it hasn't been published, but the thing is, I would love to get it published, but times change, and so it becomes a little harder to do these things. And so, but of the acting, Leave It to Me. He used to have hit after hit after hit. I never knew anybody to have so many hit shows, but he always did. And he deserved them. He was quite a good actor. And we became even closer friends. And I ended up living with the Gaxtons in Stamford, Connecticut, on a 47-acre estate with a 5-acre lake. And we really had a time up there. And then there was another day, his brother-in-law was there. He said, "We need a chicken coop. We have to have chickens on this place." And so Freddie got... all these stars used to come up in overalls and what have you. And they were all hammering away to build this chicken coop. When it was completed, the neighbors all started to come up to the estate. They didn't want the eggs. They wanted to see the estate, but that was their way to get up to see it. And what happened was... I thought to myself, we said we need egg boxes. He said, "I'll go get the egg boxes," which they got. They used to put the eggs in paper bags. And when I went to New York with what I wanted to put on the egg boxes was I thought of something and I asked my uncle, who's a linotype operator, if he could give me 1,000 labels gummed down. I didn't want to gum them down myself. And so he did that while I waited. And when I went back and I put them on the boxes, everybody was coming up. And what I put on the boxes was two or three strips of scotch tape, not scotch tape, but tape that gums down. And it said, "Eat Gaxton's eggs and become a star." And I sent a bunch of them to Hollywood. He was there making a movie. And the next day he called me on the phone and he couldn't talk to me. He was laughing so hard. He says, "Whose idea was this, Leo?" I said, "It was my idea." He says, "It's the greatest public relations stunt I've ever been in my life." Marie Chevalier once told me something that I did with him the same way. And I can only tell you, we were giving the eggs away, you know, 100 chicks. It's a lot of eggs every day. But this is what we did. And I don't know, but he's coming into it now. I went over to the Radio City Music Hall, their office building. And what happened was that... I went to see my friend Dick Williams, who was an usher at the Center Theater when I was there. He got a job with Mike Todd in public relations, and he asked me to come over. So I went over, and I was standing there talking with him. And I said, "What is this machine here?" He says, "It's a multiograph machine. I'm in business with this young man, Al, here, that's sitting here." And just prior to the opening of the World's Fair, and he said... we're going to be doing public relations layouts for the press agents that handle the shows, and we'll print them up and take them around to the newspapers. In the meantime, I never saw Mike Todd. I never even heard of him in those days. And this man steps out of this office and says to this young man, "Al, I'm so starving and hungry, and I don't have time to go down and get a sandwich. Would you go down and get me a sandwich, please?" And this young man says to him, "I'm very sorry, but I'll gladly go down and get you a sandwich, but I won't do it any other way." And he says, "That's how you talk to me? You're here rent-free, everything for nothing, and you can't even get me a sandwich?" He said, "Well, you're not also going to work at the World's Fair." And he says, "You're finished as far as working for the World's Fair." And he turns to me and he says to me, "You want to work for me?" I said, "Sure." And I had a job for $14 a week. And I said, "Sure." And he says, you hit it on the nose. "You're my office boy, $10 a week. Now go get me a sandwich." And that's how I started with Mike Todd. A couple of weeks later, Bill Dollar's press agent calls me in. "We're promoting you to assistant press agent with an expense account." So I said, "Well, I appreciate that." And things started to change for me. I could notice everything in my life was changing, but so fast I just couldn't keep up with it. But I said, Dick, what do you want? What does he want me for? He says, he thinks you're a photographer. I said, what are you talking about? I was his photographer, and he's going out on another job, and I told him to find somebody to replace you, and he picked you. So I said, but I don't know how to take pictures. I never took any in my life. So he says, I'm leaving in about 3 or 4 days. I'll teach you how to take pictures. And so finally, when he left, he taught me how to load the cameras. And the next day, 2 days later, I got a cablegram from him. You put all, there were 36 slides taken. I had 36 blanks. I had nothing on the film. I said, oh, my God, am I in trouble. So, but nothing happened. No one bothered me. And so they said, well, how'd you get 36 blanks? I said, I'll tell you later. I'm going down to New York to our camera store. I'm going to ask him what happened. And I forgot to pull the bellows out on the camera. And those were the circles that were on the film that I had. And this is how this thing went. And finally, he liked me, and this I knew that he took a liking to me. And I had a car. I bought a little car. I think it was a Chevy. And I had heard that Mike was fooling around with Gypsy, but I never said anything. It was none of my business. And so what happened was that he said, I want to borrow your car. I hear you got a car and I would like to borrow it. I said, you don't have to like to borrow it. It's just for you. He said, no, I want to pay for it. And I said, what do you want to pay? And he said, $10 a day for the car. I said, oh, you got it. And he said to me, I hear that you've been doing some work at the fairgrounds now for other people other than myself, and you're using my film, my darkroom that I built for you, and the cameras that I bought for you. I said, yes. He says, how much money have you made? I said, enough. So he said, you made enough money? He says, why are you saying that? I said, well, it's nice to know that I'm going to have a job for the next 10 years. He says, what do you mean by that? I said, he made that much money? I said, no, but I'm just teasing. And it sort of annoyed him, and he got angry, and he started to throw everything at me on his desk. And I escaped out of that room because the door was locked. And I went down on the World Fair grounds. And he said, we have a stunt down there that we want you to handle for us. We'll see how you handle stunts. And I had to hire my friends at 10 bucks a day to do these stunts. They were in all different types of costumes. And they had these little square things in their hands. And they used to walk over to people and just tap them on the back and say, Gypsy Rose Lee is stuck on me. And I said, how did it go? And I saw him the next day or so. He said, they went along great, and you did a great job, and I'm glad that I picked you. So that's about it with Mike Todd.
And can you give me an idea of what the
Gypsy
Rose world was like when you started out? I mean, it was before
Oh, you were right. The Telegram, the Sun. Well, I didn't know anybody, really, and there was this press agent by the name of Saul Jacobson, who just died. He was, I think he was 96 or 97 years old. And he sort of liked me, and I said, you know, I really would like to do a Broadway show. He says, well, you don't have enough talent to do a Broadway show. He said, but when you build up to it, and I think you will, you can remember me. And I just saw him in New York because Samuel Friedman was a press agent, and his sister, his sister They were redoing a theater, and his sister got all these people that she knew that were still around to come to the opening of the new Samuel J. Theater. Samuel J. Friedman, spelt the same way. But that was about it, how it had happened. It's still there, because I asked people on occasion when they're from New York, have you seen the Samuel J. Friedman theaters? It's still there, and they said yes. But that's how it all started with Todd. And then one day, go ahead. I didn't know anybody, because I never did Broadway shows. I didn't know what it was all about. Well, what happened first, there was a group that were always together doing these shows, and I didn't know what it was all about. But what I did was, when I got this extra money that I got a raise when I was promoted to an assistant press agent, when I did the extra shows and such, I made enough money to buy a small little car. And when Todd wanted the car, he says, "Now I know why you got a car." He says, "I can't afford one, and you're driving a car that I probably bought for you." I said, "Yes, you did buy it for me, and I really appreciate it." So. But they had a lot of, I guess they call them press agents, but I knew Frank very well. That was on the last show. I just spoke to Frank Goodman just before he died. Oh, really? He was very excitable type of guy, because when I went back to Stratford and Hepburn and I sent her those proofs, he screamed like you can't believe. But you know that, don't you? The screams. Okay. But what happened with that was that I don't know how it worked out, but I sent him the proofs with the flashlight and the magnifier on it, and he thought they were coming with 4x5 speed graphic slides. "Why did you do this? You got me in trouble," and he's screaming all over the place. I said, "Just send them to her and tell her I did it." And I already passed what I told you before about her loving the pictures and so forth. So he never bothered me again after that. But I did a lot of work for Frank. And actually, yes, I did. It was before The Prince and the Showgirl, but it was during that time I was talking to Sir Lawrence that he told me what we were doing was, how did that work out? There are a couple of incidents with, when he signed to do The Prince and the Sun Girl with her, my God, all heck broke loose in the theater. You can't imagine it. People, they all talk it. Can you imagine he's going to play that part? Well, anyhow, it was set up that the Plaza Hotel, they were having in the ballroom. They had these little ballrooms above the stage, and if one flight up, he was terrific, Olivier, nicest man, just lovely. But I got to know him, and the more you got to know him, the better you liked him. But they were invited to the press conference in the ballroom of the Plaza Hotel, and they both arrived there, but they arrived up at the balcony, the little balconies, the one flight above it. And when the press saw Marilyn Monroe with Olivier, the screaming, you can't imagine, the walls were rocking. And the photographers were yelling, "Marilyn, bend down, Marilyn," because she was one flight below where the rest of them were. And she's having a ball with her contortions and that she was with her mouth and such. And as she came down, as she looked down, they kept saying, "Lean further, Marilyn, lean further." And they finally ended up with her. I found no interest in that, to shoot, because I was different. I didn't want, well, you said it earlier about a paparazzi. That was the closest I ever came to a paparazzi, believe me. And what had happened was, down they both went. Oh, no. What happened was, when she finished, Olivier walked to the end of the balcony, and he leaned over and he said, "Does anybody here want me to bend down?" And the place just rocked with laughter. And then that night he said he was going, no, Milton Greene was more or less handling her, managing her, I would say. And I knew nothing about this. But he had a contract with Look magazine, and I was told that he was fired that morning. And and Olivier said to me, "We're going to a show tonight, and I only want you to listen to what I tell you, nobody else, because I can see how he's treating you. You're handling it very, very well." I said, "Well, I'm ready to put the camera down his throat." Every time he got out of the car that arrived at the theater, he'd get out of the car and he'd run and stand in front of me and wouldn't give me any space to take anything. The first time I said, "Milton, please step out of my way." And he didn't answer me. The second time I said, "Milton, I told you once before, stay away from me. I have a job to do and I don't intend for you to destroy it for me." So during intermission, Olivier came out on the street and he came to where I was standing. And I said, "Where's Marilyn?" He says, "There'd be a riot here if you came out with Marilyn. Me, they don't even know who I am." So I said, "Well, I know who you are." And he says, "You're doing a good job and I like you." So that ended that series. And I don't know what else to tell you about it. Yes, I do. Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton, as far as doing things with them, I never... Richard was a close friend of mine. He'd call me in the morning to have breakfast with him and so forth. And while I'd go over to him and have breakfast with him, I'd eat ham and eggs, and he's drinking beer. So I said, "Richard, why do you drink all that stuff for? Why don't you just leave it alone and do your job? You're doing a good job of it." So he says, "I'm here with Elizabeth." I said, there was a show called Rugantino that was playing in the O'Keefe Center in Toronto. And it was Richard who got hold of me and said, "It's Elizabeth's birthday and Life magazine is shooting the show." And they never liked anybody in to shoot when they're shooting. But I never asked. I did it first, and then if they didn't want it, they'd tell me. Not that much I learned. And I never overstepped their bounds. And so here they are doing this show. And he says, "It's Elizabeth's 30th, I think it was the 37th birthday." And I had never met her. We got talking, he never introduced it to me, but they went to see Rugantino that night. And I knew that nobody was going to come through those doors with the snow all over the place and what have you. And I was the only one that stayed inside. And when Richard walked in with Elizabeth, I put my camera up to take a picture of her, and she started to run away. And he said, "Leo, what are you doing here?" I said, "I'm here because of you." He said, told some of the actors, "Bring her back here." He said, "I want a picture of her with the birthday cake." I said, "Okay." So he brought her back, and he said, "Leo, this is Elizabeth Taylor. I'd like you to meet her." And when talking, she said to me, "You know, you're the first photographer that never asked for permission to take a picture of me." You always ask, I'm sorry, I contradicted myself. You always ask to take a picture of me. And I said, well... That's what she said, yes, you hit it on the nose. And... Well, she said, I'm the only photographer that ever asked for permission to take her picture. I said, well, I'm honored. I said, I would never think that. And she said, well, you think it now. And I said, but what am I going to do for a picture? I need a gimmick. And Life magazine, I saw, noticed his cameras were all empty. He was loading his film as fast as he could. And I said, I got to get an exclusive on this. And how did I come out with it? Oh, I said, Elizabeth, we're going to take a picture of you cutting the cake with Hamlet's sword. Because Richard was in his finale costume, and I just wanted a picture that way. That's the only thing I could think of. And I did that, and from that time on, she and I became very good friends. It's funny how these things work out. And when they were in Toronto, and this show was heading to New York, I think, the next day or a couple of days later. And what had happened was that, although I can't think of his last name, I have it in the book, was a big, heavy-set gentleman who goes out on the road and he brings his own food. And he had all his own food he brought in from Italy, and it's now in Toronto, and the customs don't want to let him get out of customs with all that food. But they eventually made a deal, and he got him an apartment in New York, and he ate all his food in the apartment. But as far as... $2,000. Right. And that is a lot of money in those days. No. I was looking for it. I wanted to do a show more than anything else. And I didn't care about the money. But the only thing I needed from the show was money to buy more equipment, which is what I did. And it worked out fine for me. But Elizabeth and Richard used to go out on the street, and they were surrounded by four, five, six people deep around them as they would walk. And I said, my God, how do these people enjoy themselves? But this is what had happened, and I was grateful because they were doing things for me. And then came the party, and Elizabeth saw me walk into this big rehearsal hall. It was like Radio City Music Hall, the O'Keefe Center. And she saw me walk into the hall, and she was with Richard, but she left Richard and went up this short flight of stairs to meet me. And she said to me, where are your cameras? I said, Elizabeth, you don't need me anymore. It's now almost 5 o'clock in the morning. I said, I can't even hold the camera anymore. But what do you want them for? She said, of course, I want you to make money. I said, well, it's very nice of you to say that about me, and that means a lot of money on this picture. She says, nobody else will have it. And she says, how do you stop the stagehands? I said, I'll tell them to keep it dark. And that's what I did. And I have the picture of that shot, and I had Harry being congratulated by Hume Cronin and who else was in the show at the time. But this is how things kept going uphill for me all the time. Silk Stockings with Don Ameche and Hildegard Neff. And I just happened to be, I never shot a Broadway show, and I just happened to be in my studio when the phone rang, and it was Saul Jacobson who was calling. And he says, I'm glad I found you. I said, I need you in Philadelphia. We had hired another photographer, and she's not going to be here. She's caught in a snowstorm on the way back and so forth. And I said, but you said you that I don't have enough experience. He says, well, you're going to have enough experience tonight. But the thing was, we didn't shoot the show that night because of the weather. And the next time I got together with them was when I can't, it slips my mind, there's so much I remember and so much I forgot. But what I'm trying to remember was that I just cannot. What's that?
You were saying silk stockings was your big breakthrough, and then what happened after silk stockings?
What was your next big breakthrough? The phone was ringing off the hook, and when I did that show, and what happened was that she was very happy, you know, that it was working out that way. But she wasn't looking for any publicity or any type of public relations. She was just very, very nice. And I enjoyed being with her all the time. As a matter of Elizabeth. And what happened was, we were now going from Toronto to New York to bring the show into New York. And so I got on the plane and flew out. And lots of times people never told me to go. They knew that I had sense enough to recognize what would make a big layout in a magazine. I didn't go to Life because Life, I always used to, I'd give them an idea of a chorus girl with a blue eye and a yellow eye. And I said, make a heck of a picture and then take a picture the way she really is now. And what do? They hire their own man to do the story and would used to skip me. So I started to refuse to do work for for Life magazine. I was angry about it, and I had a right to be angry. And it wasn't the first time that this happened with them. So anyhow, Richard used to call me to come to the Actors Club with him. So I'd go and we'd sit down in the corner on the floor, and we started to talk about different dialects. And this man had the greatest dialect that you could ever want, his voice. And before long, we looked around and we were completely surrounded by people that were at the Actors Club. And they were all speaking to him about his accent and so forth. And the man was fantastic. He really was. He was a very nice person. But things happened, you know, and so forth. And then all of a sudden he sort of disappeared because he got sick. And I was sort of worried about him because I didn't know whether he was drinking too much, which I really thought he was. And this is how these things work out. And I sure was. Well, you can't get any action on 4x5 speed graphics. Van Damme, who did this work before me, used to use 8x10 slides. Now, and then she'd say, hold it, and everybody's falling all over the place because they can't stand still. And here I come along with 35mm, and I want them to move around. But this is how it happened, and this really made me. And all this group that used to work together wasn't working together so much anymore. I didn't ask them to leave. But as far as this gal was concerned that I was talking to about it, Julie Newmar was in Silk Stockings. And I said to Harvey Sabinson, the press agent, I said, Harvey, I don't understand why I don't see anything in the papers or in the magazines on Julie Newmar. This girl was beautiful. She had a figure you just can't believe. And all of a sudden, I said, what's the problem? He said, she eats with her fingers. I said, I don't understand what you're talking about. He says, nobody wants to do any work on her because she never orders any food with a knife and fork on the plate. And she would go with the cast after the performance of the shows they were in Philadelphia. And it worked out that she would stand behind them and walk behind them. And when they would walk, when they brought the food in, they were walking behind the customer to put the server at the table, she had a plate in her hand. And she, what happened with her was that she would reach over into the other person's plate and with her fingers take a handful of peas or stuff like that. Maybe I'm leaving myself open to a lawsuit, I don't know, but this is what she did. And I didn't say anything to her. And then I was told another thing. They said, she also doesn't have a room at the hotel to sleep tonight. She brings a sleeping bag and goes down to the ladies' lounge, spreads it out, and goes to sleep for the night after the show is closed for the evening. So, but that was, and then I went to dinner. I went to dinner with her, and she did the same thing with me. She took all these peas and just shoved them off her plate onto my plate. And that was the last I ever saw or heard from her again. Well, Ingrid Bergman had a press agent call me and asked if I was busy, if I was available for the next 2 weeks. She needed a photographer. I didn't know Ingrid Bergman. I never met her. And they recommended me. And what happened was she would pick me up every morning in a big limousine with that she had a driver and pick me up at my studio, and we'd go up Fifth Avenue to the museum that was making the armor I forgot what the part she was going to play. Joan of Arc, that's right. And she would make this appointment, and I'd go up there, and I never spoke with her. I got in the car and said good morning to her, and she never answered me, and we spoke another word. And so here I'm at the museum. I got a picture on my wall of that. In my studio, and this is what had happened there, and I couldn't understand why everybody is getting on my back and saying you're doing a terrific job, your pictures are. What was it was the candids. I knew how to take candids a little differently than other people, but I had to teach myself. And, yeah, that had something to do with it also. I remember Martha Swope, I helped her get into this rat race, boy, it became that after a while. And I helped her get into this. I told her, she asked me some questions about how do you take a picture so-and-so. And I said, two lights, it's all I have, Martha. And I can tell you this, that I showed her how to set the two lights as long as it doesn't leak over onto the camera. And so that's how she got started. But it was just fantastic the way these things, as you asked, how it started. It started by itself. And I was with Martha and at her house, not in her house, in an apartment building in New York where she lived. And she was talking to me out downstairs in the street, and a gentleman came over, and he said, Martha, how are you? And she says, I'm fine. She says, I'd like you to meet Leo Friedman. And he stopped dead on his feet when my name was mentioned, and he looked at her, and she said, yes, it is, without saying another word. He says, you're a legend. I said, what? He says, you're a legend. I met lots of people that never knew me. That my wife had a girlfriend who came to New York to visit us, and She needed a music store, and I said, one is up the street from here. She went in and walked into buying someone a gift, and I walked down to the where they were making all the show albums. And there was a young man standing there, and when my wife's friend was finished what she went in the store for, she says, what are you doing here? I said, you see this? And I held up West Side Story album cover. They made it small, you know, small sizes. And I made this thing, and she said, I didn't know that that you did this. I said, well, what do you think I'd come to New York for? So I was always going back and forth, back and forth. I could have... Yeah, well, what happened was... No, that came a little later. But I just wanted to finish with this by telling you this girl, she says, I didn't know that you do things like this. I said, well, what do you think I do? And so I said, I photographed this cover. She says, you did? I said, my name's on it. So she couldn't believe it. She said she was going crazy. She knows a celebrity. but that didn't bother me. But the thing was, this young man interrupted. He says, excuse me. He says, are you Friedman or Abels? I said, I'm Friedman. Why do you ask? He said, you take the best pictures I've ever seen in the theater. I said, are you connected with the theater? And he said, no. He says, I sing in the church choir, and that's as far as the theater goes with me. But I follow everything in the theater, and your pictures are unbelievable. There's another story about that. If I'm skipping something, I don't know. But we went to London, and we went to Cheshire Cheese, which is an old pub, for lunch. And everybody sits at tables, and you sit wherever you want. And there's two young men facing me and my wife. And we got talking, and I said, what do you fellas do for a living? They said, we're photographers. I said, you are? He said, yeah. He said, what do you do for a living? I said, I happen to be a photographer also. He said, are you from New York? I said, yes. He said, by chance, would you be Friedman and Abels? I said, no, just Friedman. Well, they got so excited, they kept bothering me. They wanted me to take me back to their editor at the newspaper on Fleet Street. And this is how I got to know people. He's another one. He fired me. David Merrick does crazy things. I was in Toronto. No, I was in Boston doing 110 in the Shade. And at intermission, Harvey Savinson walks down the aisle and he says to me, Leo, do you have any trouble with David today? I said, no. He said, what happened? I said, I came in. I said, good morning, David. How are you? And he said, fine. That's all I said to him. I said, why do you ask? He says, because he told me to fire you. I said, for what? He said, I don't know. That's why I'm asking you. I said, I had nothing to do with him. I do all his shows, and he never complains, and all of a sudden he's got a complaint about one of them. Why, I don't know, but as far as that goes, what are you going to do? I said, I'm packing up and going back, and I'm going to get paid for a show that I didn't do. So I didn't do the next season. I didn't do a couple of his shows, and Harvey was going crazy. He says, I can't get anybody to do a show anymore like Leo used to have. He says, well, why'd you fire him? He says, I don't know, but maybe just time. So what happened was, I said, and he doesn't want you now. He says, Leo Friedman doesn't know how to take pictures. I did 144 shows. No, more than that. I did over 1,000 shows on Broadway. And they're telling me I don't know how to take pictures. Never heard anything so stupid. Huh? Who's going to wait that long to fire somebody? So what happened was I'm just trying to I'm just trying to think about what I'm about to say. Sometimes I skip things or forget for certain things I don't know. I got my dog, Scampi. He's named after a Walt Disney dog. He's a little Maltese. I used to take him on local picture calls. And I'd take him to the theater, and I'd sit him in the seat, and I said, go to sleep, Scamp. And he'd go to sleep, and I'd go on stage and work until 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. And when I wanted him, I saw the theater was very dark, and the audience gone, and here's this little dog sleeping on a seat. So I said to my assistant, you know, that would make a heck of a good picture. It could be a cover on one of the big magazines. So I said, well, here's what happens. I don't want you to wake him. I don't want you to even go near him because I don't want him to wake up. I want him sleeping. So go up, Nat, go into the row, take a meter reading, come back and tell me what to shoot at. So they came back and told me what to do, and I told the stagehands, bring up all the lights in the theater because I had taken the meter reading before the lights went down. He brought up the lights, and I yelled, Scamp! He looked up from a sleeping position, and that's the picture I got on the theater. It's one of my favorite pictures. The other one would be West Side Story. I got a call once on that from San Francisco, and he's the writer of a story for Smith's Supermarket. Yeah, it was a supermarket. But anyhow, he started to question me about that picture with Cara Lawrence and I forget his name, young man, nice young man. But where did I take it? I said around the corner from my studio. On 9th Avenue and 54th Street or something like that.
Smithsonian magazine.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. We got cut off. I was out on the street with the press agent, Reuben Rabinowitz. And I saw them running, and I said, you know, that might make, I didn't know anything about West Side Story, but what the picture just says so much about the show that I said, I made a mark on the street. And I said to Carol, I want Larry chasing you up the street. When you hit that mark, don't look at me down here. Look up with your head up and cross it. And that's what I took. I hate to tell you how many people have ordered that picture since I started with it. And Cal told everybody I had her running up and down the street 300 times. I said she'd be dead if I had said that to her. But anyhow, this is what had happened with that. But I got a story from, and then the magazine, the Smithsonian magazine was the magazine I was trying to think of. And they ran, I don't know, 3 or 4 pages of that. And then Times Magazine ran it. It ran an 2 pages on me. They were interviewing me because, where's that paper? Can someone hand it to me, please? The top one. Yeah. I got a paper here. It says, when I returned, I lent the New York Public Library. That's not the one? Hold on just a moment, please. What I'm looking for is I almost won a Tony Award last year. No. Please contact us through website for more stories. What are you looking for?
Are you looking for a story?
No, not, no. My in Life magazine. Yeah. Yeah. Yes, there's one on a show called Rhinoceros with Zero Mostel and Eli Wallach. And I can only tell you that the man who did the sets, I think, his wife calls me from time to time. She says, "I still don't understand how you got that picture." I said, "What do you mean?" Because Eli Wallach is flying through the air, and I just clicked that shutter, and I got him right in the center of the whole thing with Zero pushing him from sitting down at a table. And to me, that's really a great picture, but they all can't be great, so I don't know. But getting back to this guy that called me a legend, I was shocked. I couldn't believe it. I still to this day say the same thing. I'm a legend. Is there anything else you want me to say on that or talk about? Yes, I sure did. I went up for the dress rehearsal in Boston, and I was walking out for dinner, and someone called me out on the street, and I turned around, and it was Joel Grey. He used to live with, he was married and he had a child, the one that just won the stars. Dancing with the Stars. And my son used to play with her in Central Park when he was in the same age bracket. But Joel and I told Joel had one bad eye, it's crossed, and I knew how to move his head in the exact same rotation to straighten the eye out, and that's what I used to do. Joel do this and this and this, and he do it, and I gave him sets of pictures that you can't believe, because and he was cross-eyed. You see his eyes and they're straight, but he's away from that and they're crooked. So I did that show, and I did a couple other shows for him. I did about two or three shows like that of Joel. And then Joel got into the George M. Cohan thing. He went out to California with the show. And he wanted Milton Green to shoot the show, not me. After what I did for him, Milton couldn't shoot an outside a Broadway show if he saved his life. He was great in the studio. But forget anything else, because I'd like to just slip over to Alan Lerner. What's the name of that story? It was a musical, a big musical. Yeah. What was that? No. After that. Yeah. It was a big Broadway musical. And anyhow, I went up to, it was a crazy weekend. It was a Labor Day weekend. And oh my God, nobody was ready for me. I'm just traveling around from place to place. And I went to Philadelphia. From Philly, I went to Boston. From Boston, I drove back to New York, because Philadelphia wasn't available for me. And with that, I said, I can't drive another inch. Let's take a bus. You got 2 hours sleep on a bus. We parked the car and took the bus, and we got our rest. But when we came back, we had to go back up to Boston again, Alan Lerner. wants to talk to me. So when I got up there, I said, what's happened? We got there wee hours of the morning. And I was with my wife. And she says to me, where are we going to sleep tonight? I said, take a seat. She said, what do you mean by that? I said, can you understand what I was saying? She says, no, but take a seat anyway. And I introduced her to Alan and so forth. And he said, we're going through nonstop. We're going to start tomorrow morning and go through nonstop. Well, all it was stop and go. It was going crazy. I didn't know where I was. But anyhow, this man was terrific to me as far as I'm concerned. I really enjoyed working for him. But then there was a show called All American that he was doing. I think he was doing that with Alan Lerner. I'm not sure. But what had happened was Milton Greene was doing a story on his wife and little boys, a book on them. And I heard him go over to Alan Lerner and say to him, I want every photographer out of here. So Lerner looks up and he comes eye to eye with me. And he says, I'll put them all out except that one right there. And he said, why don't you want him out? He said, because I don't want him out. If you want him out, you go out too, because you're going to be finished. And that was the end. The book wasn't published or anything. No pictures were taken. But these are... Go ahead. Do you want me to call you from when I get back to my house? I see. I can keep you going on for days. Right. Well, the shows don't go out of town anymore. The previews are all done in New York. Well, I used to go out of town to photograph the previews before it came to New York. But now they only seem to work one way in New York, and that's it, to save money, I'm sure. I don't know if you knew that. But if they... No, Billy Jackson and I were, you can't imagine. I mean, he sold one of his houses on his estate to a guy named Bill Adriance, who was in the society business with his wife. Anyhow, what happened was, oh my! I have a note that I made, and I'm. Can I get time for me to repeat it? Hello. When I retired, I lent the New York Public Library all my photographs, all of my photographs. Now I'm trying to get them back. I don't know if you know this, but oh my God! They stole my collection. And that's it. Yep. Well, it's been going on a long time, but this is what happened. My life's work. They don't want to return. I want them to return it. Great talking to you. Well, as much as I can. But thank you very much. It was nice talking to you.
Thank you very much.
You bet. Bye now.